a king has to go, in other words, think independently. He can listen to advice. He should listen to advice from many people. You hear many ideas, but the final decision has to be, after he thinks it through, to know which direction to go in. You see? So he has to be an independent thinker to do that which is correct. Okay? So therefore, when they feared God, you see, fearing God means that they're independent thinkers and that they're able to stand up to do that which is right, despite the fact that their life is in danger, despite the fact that the authority figure and their emotions would be go against them, and they don't, in other words, they don't follow that, or the authority figure doesn't exist. They undid it. Through study, they became independent thinkers, and therefore they don't make a decision that way. Therefore, their descendants, who would be raised with that type of with that trait, so they would be raised with that trait, it would affect them, that they would be able to be fitting to be kings, because they would be independent thinkers. And the question is the conscience, or the relationship to authority, is how is that different from wisdom? Because a lot of people, a lot of good things come, that's the way all training starts out in a child. Training starts out is the fact that he has a conscience. If the child didn't have a conscience, you wouldn't be able to train them. They'd be animals. You know what I mean? Like, there's certain kids that are raised by wolves. They say that if they get them and they catch them, let's say at 13, they never develop much beyond a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old. They don't develop much beyond that because all their lives they weren't trained. They were trained basically in their animal desires, you see, carrying out. Their conscience was the wolves, you see. So the thing is that so that's a good thing for raising a person. But a conscience also makes you dependent if it's also dependent on authority. In other words, most people are dependent on different authorities, okay? Society, certain political organization, I mean, whatever it is, a certain view is based on the way you were raised. So all these things are based on authority. They could go to extremes, or they even not to extremes, they could go beyond which is rational to act like, act. So therefore, even if you act correctly based on your conscience, you still need wisdom to make sure you don't go beyond either too much or too little. In other words, some people fight their conscience and they try and give in to their emotions, so they go too far to the animalistic part of you. Other people go too far to the conscience part. But it's wisdom that makes sure that you keep the straight and narrow path. So therefore, that is where wisdom comes in. In other words, if you're raised with good qualities, that is good. But however, it takes wisdom to make sure that that it doesn't take over, and you're guided by the correct ideas based on reality, based on your knowledge of truth and reality. You're born with a conscience, and it, whoever raises you forms the nature of the conscience. Okay, whoever raises you forms the nature of the conscience in the first few years, probably around the first five years of life. Wisdom first comes about, like they say, around 13, like, you know, about that age the mind is developed where you can get into the world of ideas and thoughts. The question is, what is wisdom? Wisdom is, wisdom, according to King Solomon, is where you have the ability to be guided by your mind despite your emotions. In other words, it's not a, in other words, let's say, for instance, you study mathematics and you're a great mathematician and you're a thinker. But however, you don't apply that to your emotions the way you live your life, we would not call that a wise person. But a person that's a mathematician, after they've trained their mind, then it would be good if they would study the ideas of Mishlei so that they learn to make correct decisions despite despite their emotions, they're able to make correct decisions. That is a wise person. Okay? In other words, you need training of the mind. In the Jewish world, the training of the mind is Gemara and Talmud, you see? While in the non-Jewish world, the training of the mind would be like mathematics. In other words, the conscience and the animalistic instincts are both of them, you're unaware how it works, and both of them are really the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, in the sense that they make you make decisions without thought, and therefore you really don't know if you're right. In other words, let's say, for instance, you belong to the Muslims, and you're raised that you should be a suicide bomber and you go straight to heaven. So that's a conscience. In other words, you were raised that way, and therefore you do it. You see? So therefore, that's not thought. That's an evil act based on your conscience. You see? You could be, or you could turn animalistic, where you go out and have the pleasures of life and do whatever you feel like at any given moment and give in to your animalistic desires.
Those are both negative. Now, what about...
When a person is trained, sometimes they're trained in a household where they're basically like they know not to steal, they know not to murder, and they're raised with good qualities, you see. So they're basically in a certain framework, but without learning, the question is, what is robbery? In other words, many of these people will go into a motel and walk out with towels or with silverware and not feel that they're stealing. Without asking permission, they feel, well, everybody does it. That gives them the right. You see, it has to be thought out. You understand, you're working in an office, and you need a stamp for your personal thing. So you take a stamp. You're working for a $1 million organization. What's 37 cents? What's the big deal? You see? So you could bypass the conscience with these type of arguments. You cannot bypass rationale with these type of arguments. Either it's stealing or it's not stealing. Which one? But if you don't think it through, you could bypass the conscience. So in that type of household, that becomes the problem, that they start bypassing the conscience, and how far will they go? It's hard to tell. It could lead to other things. It can lead to other things if they bypass the conscience enough. They could take step by step until they move away from the conscience altogether. Or they'll go too far in the conscience. They'll go to the opposite extreme. Okay? Everybody would agree that gossip, talking about people, is an evil thing, yet how many people, just gossip, you know, like it's a natural thing. Like, everybody does it. How could you live without it? These are the arguments that give them license to bypass the conscience. It's only words. It's not an action. That's another argument with Lashon Hara. I mean, that's only words. What are words? Words is not an action. You see, they have today in America freedom of expression, so they allow people that undermine the government to talk against the government, talk about the downfall of the government. They have that right, as long as they don't do anything. And they're undermining people and destroying the very nature of the government, and they're allowing this to happen. This is an extreme in freedom of speech. So it's an extreme. It's definitely irrational to allow that in a government, that people should give ideas. But the thing is that that's only where the mind sees these ideas, but the conscience doesn't. The conscience bypasses it, and they go to extremes, you see, in these subtle ways, and from these subtle ways it leads to worse things. I would just like to say one thing, and that is that the ideas of Mishlei that we're just talking about deals with emotions that you have to make decisions in everyday life, rational decisions like we were just talking about.
That isn't conscience, though.
In other words, you could look at the conscience as a judge, okay? That the judge decides what's right or wrong, okay? Now, let's say the judge says you're not allowed to steal. Okay? Now, you bypass the judge that's judging you by saying, well, nobody cares if I take a towel, or everybody is doing it. You understand? So you bypass this judge that constantly judges you by these rationalizations that you bypass. But that is all based on an unconscious judge. It's not based on rationale where the mind thinks it through and says, what is the right thing? Am I allowed to steal or not allowed to steal in this situation? You see? So you could look at the conscious as a judge or an authority telling you what's right or wrong. A good example that Doug gave was, if, let's say, for instance, you feel guilty that you didn't vacuum the rug once a week. Every week you vacuum the rug, and one week you didn't have time, and you feel guilty about it. Now, that doesn't have to do with right or wrong. It's a practical thing. Is the house clean? So let's say 1 week you skip. It's not the worst thing in the world. Unless you have allergies, then it's a practical thing. But the thing is, you start feeling guilty about it, like there's something in there judging you that's saying you must do this. You see? Some people, when they get up in the morning, they brush their teeth, either because it's because of health reasons, or they can't tolerate the bad taste in their mouth. That's a practical reason. But some people get up in the morning, they have to do it. If they don't do it, they feel guilty. You see, that's the judge in them. That's the conscience telling them that, that's the authority judging you that you're doing something wrong. And these things are not good and evil. These things are practical. They're harmful. If you don't do it, it might be harmful. If you stop brushing your teeth altogether, it will be harmful. You see? But if you miss one day, it's not. I mean, okay, so then you can do it the next day. But however, and that won't be harmful. I can't imagine if you miss once a month, it's going to be harmful. But if you feel guilty about it, it means that you're saying this is evil. Why should you feel guilty about something that's practical? You see? So therefore, that is the conscience or this authority figure judging you at that moment and deciding what is right or wrong. That's the same authority figure which will tell you what is stealing, and then the other part of you rationalizes to bypass this feeling of guilt, you see? So that, in other words, the rationalization of the stealing is only to bypass so you shouldn't feel guilty when you want to do something wrong, you see? But wisdom will show you what stealing really is and what the consequences of stealing, what it leads to. So that's a different type of, that's where the mind sees clearly why you shouldn't steal and why you should be just. Like we were saying before, that Mishlei deals with these type of situations in your everyday life and your decision making. But however, the emotion of the authority figure itself that you relate to and relating to God correctly through thought, that's the book of Tillim that deals with that idea, how to relate to God through thought. And the two subjects that I found in Tillim or Psalms is, one is sciences, they talk about different sciences, and two is they talk about the idea of prayer and how it works, you see. And the idea of prayer will show you, or the idea itself will get you away from the Psalms. King David's view of prayer will get you away from this authority view of life, and that's constantly judging you to a rational view of prayer and relationship to God. And the science says you relate to God through wisdom, and so therefore, once you relate to God through wisdom, that undoes this relationship. Everybody must start out when they start out in a religious relationship to God, start out with their conscience, that God is some type of authority. But it has to change, and it can change through wisdom in your relationship to God. So the first book should be Mishlei in the Everyday, which is simpler in the everyday life to make rational decisions in the everyday life and to become a chacham. And then In Mishlei, we deal with the Chacham and the Tzaddik, because Tzaddik is doing justice, and you can see justice also as a result of consequences. But however, in Tillim, they use the term Chassid. Chassid is Chesed, kindness. When you relate to God, then you relate to people through kindness, you see. So therefore, it's a different quality that is brought out through your relationship to God when it comes through the wisdom of God, where you relate to God that God is the source of all wisdom instead of God is an authority that punishes you. Okay? So that's the two books, the Mishlei and Tillim, what their purpose is. In the, okay, new point. In the book of Judges, that Shoftim, chapter 5, verse 23, this is still part of Devorah's praise of God, a song of God. And then at the end, she talks against certain people that they didn't join. But however, in 23, she says, "Cursed is Meroz." Meroz is a certain city in Israel. Said an angel of God. Said an angel of God, the commentary says that this she got through prophecy. The others that she said that the people were bad because they didn't join with Israel. So that was her own rebuke of them, a personal rebuke that they didn't stand by the Jews at the time of this terrible catastrophe when they went to war. But however, against Israel. But however, this is a prophecy that you should curse this city. It says, cursed is the their inhabitants because they didn't come to the help of God, to the help of God against the mighty. So the help of God means we're supposed to do. The help of God means that that we're supposed to do, work out God's will to the best of our ability. In other words, God will help us deal with it, but God doesn't fight for us. We have to work it out. Okay? It was a special generation, the generation that came out of Egypt, that God actually fought for them. They didn't have any type of strategy of war. It was Moshe kept up his hand, which represented that they related to God. So then the God, then they would win. They didn't relate to God, then they would lose. That was just that generation. But afterwards, we needed strategy, you see. So our strategy should be in line with God's will. So God wants to help us at this situation. We should work it out. And they didn't come to work out God's will. And God wanted to help us, and they stood by the side. Okay?
It was tragic.
Now the question is, why is Meroz cursed while God did not curse the others? I mean, they were rebuked by Devorah, but it wasn't a prophecy that they should be cursed. She didn't curse the others, she just rebuked them. Over here, through prophecy of God, they were cursed. The question is, why are they cursed? And the commentaries say that Meroz was very close to the area of battle, and closeness holds you responsible, more responsible than in other situations. Okay, like for instance, you're obligated to help the poor of your city before you help the poor of another city. Okay, you're obligated to help your family before you help others, you see. So therefore, that which is close to you is a greater obligation to you than the further away you live from the situation. Even though you might have a responsibility if you're far away, but it's not equal to the responsibility of when you're close. And the question is why does closeness make a greater obligation than far away? That is the question. Right, so Doug wants to say like this, that if where you can see the pain of the other person visually with your five senses and you don't have any feelings, that's worse than a person that's far away that doesn't see it with his senses. He has to work it out with his mind. That's a very that's a chacham already. Most people are not a chacham, but so therefore, as the nation as a whole, I can't condemn. I could condemn them. I could rebuke them and show them that they're not living on the level of the mind. You see, I could show them. That's why it's rebuke. I could explain to you. I say, look, in this situation, you did a foolish thing, or you did an unjust thing. In this case, it's an unjust thing. You did something unjust, and your mind should have known that this is a situation where you should relate to God, and you should have known, so I rebuke you. But if you see somebody in pain, you're right there with them, you're there with them, and you don't have any feelings, that's even worse. Then you have no feelings for another person at all. In other words, one is a lack of feeling, compassion for another person. The other is a lack of wisdom, you see. So where you're there and we can, when you see somebody suffering, or you see that God is going to help you, and you can't visualize it, you can't see it, the need at that moment, that the people are a danger and your life is a danger and there's war right next to you. So therefore we can, for that type, where you could visualize it, in that case it's worse, and therefore God cursed them. Ruth gave the example of non-Jews during the Holocaust that saved Jews when they saw the torment that they would have, you see. So at least they had the compassion, you see. They had compassion in what they saw. Maybe they couldn't see the overall picture and fight again, you know what I mean? But they had the compassion for these people, some type of, some relationship to these people. So that shows a certain level of human decency, you see. But however, for those that turned their back, you see, they had no feeling for it. They saw destruction and they didn't do anything about it, you see. They're one step away from actually doing it. Once you turn your back, you're one step away from actually doing the terrible things. Okay, that's why they were cursed. I'd like to go into Bereshis, by the story of, it's chapter 4, verse 1, and it says, and man knew Chava's wife, means he related to her, and she conceived, and she bore Cain, saying, and she said, I have acquired a man-child for the Lord. It's Genesis 1, and in chapter 4, Genesis chapter 4, verse 1, and in the beginning of verse 2, and she again bore his brother Hevel, and that's it. Doesn't say why she named him Hevel. It just says the reason why she named him Cain. The first son with Cain comes from acquisition, that I acquired a child, and from God, and the second one just says Hebel. Now Hebel means nothing. Okay, and the question is, why did she name him nothing?
Oh, wow. That's a good
thing. Okay. So the thing is that the Ramban, Nachmanides, says she called one in the name of acquisition and the second nothing, because the acquisitions of man is equal to nothing. And she didn't want to clarify this, therefore it's not written the reason for the name of the second son, because she didn't want to say by Hebel that it's nothingness. So, but that was the thing. But the idea was that between the two children, she got across the idea that acquisitions in the physical world are equal to nothing. Okay? So the question is, why did she do that? Why did she do it? Okay? What was the purpose for naming her children in that way? The problem is, in modern times, how we name children after family. Chava named her child, according to this Ramban has other answers, but according to the answer of this Ramban, because she seemed to have a problem with her attachment to the physical world. You see, from the fact that the tree, you know, that she wanted to eat from the tree, so she realized she has a problem with an over-attachment, because there's a certain amount of attachment that's within line with reason. But where it goes over and causes you to sin, so that's an over-attachment. So she needed the help to for this. She needed a constant reminder of this idea to help her with her problem, you see? So therefore, she called her two children to make up the idea and to constantly remind her that acquisitions are, in other words, are nothing. In other words, an over-attachment to the physical is nothing. Okay?
How did she know that?
And the question is why? How was she aware of this idea? And that is because she ate from the tree, so that made her aware that she was attached to go beyond what, in other words, there's really no worry. I mean, there's plenty of fruit that she could eat from. Why did she have to eat from this one? From this particular one, you see? But the fact that she couldn't eat from it, that caused her to want to eat from it. That's an over-attachment. Okay? I'll try to explain a little better.
Well, that's fine.
Somebody told me that he had a few people over, and somehow the conversation came about that if all the laws of the Torah was removed for one day, for a 24-hour period, says, what would you do? And that, no laws. You could do whatever you feel like. He says practically everybody said that they would like to go practically everybody had to do with food. Like one wanted to go to a pancake place that, you know, the place that make pancakes. So the guy asked, but you can make just as good a pancakes, maybe even better. He says, no. He says, I want to go there. And somebody else says he'd like to go for, a hamburger. Says, yeah, but you can make better hamburgers. Those are cheap hamburgers, you know. Every one of them, except one woman. One woman, all she wanted, she dressed modestly, and all she wanted to wear was a tank top. So the thing is, I mean, it's really minute. But you really see that what's bothering them, they could have all these things within the laws of Torah. But the only thing is that, and even the woman, she could have that in the privacy of her home. She could dress that way. So the thing is that you really see that the whole thing is only restrictions, that I can't tolerate the restriction. It's not what I'm restricted of. You didn't have anything. You could do anything you want. There would be very, very little that you would do more than what you're doing now. Very little. Because the only thing what bothers you is the restriction. See, that's where we say that it's over an attachment. Where the restriction makes you do it, you see. So she felt wherever she's restricted from the physical world, that's where her desire is strongly awakened. So that's why she named her two children this idea. She called the two children to help her deal with this problem. Now, we don't name children that way anymore. Many times we name them after people, either family or if we're and we want, we name them after great people that we admire. We name them after people, that type of people. But anyway, in the time of the Torah, you see, most of the time, they named the child. If you look at the tribes also, when the tribes were named, they were named basically how the mother looked at the situation and how she related to the situation through God, and that's how she named the child. Now, we don't do that today, but there is a lesson that we could learn, and that is this, that we should make a certain atmosphere in our home, There are certain people that go to Israel to learn because they feel the atmosphere helps them. There's certain people that can't learn at home, but they could go to a yeshiva or a class. In a certain atmosphere, they could operate, but they can't operate in the privacy of their home. What I think that the message that this is telling us is that we should create an atmosphere in our home for ourselves. And that would affect the children, too. That is raising the children. In other words, most people today put the essence on what the child needs, but we forget our own needs. In other words, Chava could not have said to, or Eve could not have said to her children, I do all this for you, and this is how you act to me, because she didn't do it for them, she did it for herself. You see, that atmosphere helps the child. And I'm not saying there isn't a positive way of raising children, an active way of raising children, but there's also a subtle way, and that subtle way is that I set up an atmosphere that I need, and that it's important to me. And once it's, because if I only do it for the children, and the child senses that it's not that important to you, they'll pick that up. That they see that you're only doing it for them, but you wouldn't do it for yourself. So the thing is that when you deal with yourself and work with yourself and develop yourself, they pick up on that. That's from the atmosphere that you set up in your home. You see, a certain atmosphere with relationship to God, and the children pick up on that. You see? Now you see that Cain became attached to the physical. In other words, he couldn't give the best of his crops to God, while Hevel did. You see. Now what happened is Cain picked up on Chava's unconscious, her need for the attachment to the physical. He picked it up, but it came out in a different way than hers. You see. It's not, you understand, but it still was that attachment, you see. While Hevel was picked up on the atmosphere and the atmosphere of ideas and the relationship, total relationship to God, so therefore he was accepted. So you see that it's not the perfect system because we're humans. Humans have weaknesses, but however, as best we can, that which we need for ourselves, we should set up as a protective shield in our own homes, and that's the best we could do for our children, besides the active part of education and raising children. In other words, it can't be that she did it for the children. It can't be that she did it for the children, then she would have to name each child a different idea. You really see that the fact that since she named one acquisition and one nothing, you see, so you see, and only together does it make sense, so it couldn't have been for the children, it had to be for her. But however, that brings a certain atmosphere in the home.
That's what I was wondering.
But in other words, you see that Hevel picked up on that idea, and Cain, even though he knew God and wanted to relate to God, but there was that other part, that attachment to the physical, he must have picked that up from Chava, you see? He must have picked that up from Chava, you see? So therefore, he couldn't give him the best of his crops. Now, if the Cain sinned and God accepted Hevel's sacrifice, Cain got depressed. And God said to Cain, why are you so angry and why are you so depressed? If you do good, then you'll be uplifted. And if you don't do good, then to the doorway your sin will lurk, and to you it will be a desire, and you can rule over it. Okay? Question is, what does that verse mean? What is it talking about? So the Ramban, he quotes a few commentaries. Then he says, my opinion is, he says, that you have a greater superiority. By raising means that you could be raised to a higher level or to a higher superiority than your brother, because you're the eldest. You're the firstborn. And the reason that you were angry, what made you angry, is because you were embarrassed from your brother, that your brother, that he was successful and you weren't. Right? The competition made him embarrassed, right? So therefore you're depressed. And in his jealousy from him, he killed him. Okay? And then Nachmanides continues, and God continues talking to him. He's telling what happened later in the next verse that he killed him. We have to ask, why did Nachmanides mention that here? We'll discuss that in a minute. And he says to him, he says, there's no reason for you to be angry against your brother, and why you're depressed from him. There's no reason for that. Because if you do good, in other words, if you do good, you'll have more benefit than your brother. And if you don't do good, not only with him alone will you come to harm, but the doorway, doorway of your it'll in the doorway of your house, your sin will lurk, and it will cause you to stumble in all your ways. Okay? So the question is, what is Nachmanides saying, and how is he explaining the verse? What he means is like this. See, when you are depressed, there are two reasons for depression. One is a rational reason. Something in the physical world terrible happened. You're a normal human being, you get depressed. But sometimes depression comes about because of a incorrect emotion, a fantasy. In other words, like jealousy. Like in this case, jealousy, because he was jealous or competitive with his brother, so, and his brother was more successful, so that caused him to become depressed. Now he said, now God says to him, this depression is only telling you that there's something wrong, that you have something wrong in you, the way you look at life. Now you have two choices. You could correct it, and if you correct it in your particular case, Cain will definitely be in a better situation than ever, because he had the rights of the firstborn. So he says, so you definitely have a benefit if you just could get rid of this jealousy. Just learn to deal with your jealousy. He says, if not, the sin, that emotion, will lurk, will constantly be within you, and it'll cause you to do greater damage, and you will really be in trouble. And that's why the Ramban says that later on he killed him. Because since he did not deal with it, that emotion was brought to a higher level. Instead of dealing with it, he gave in to the emotion. The emotion reached a higher level. And then he killed Hevel. So you see that, what he's telling him, what God is telling to Cain, that you should straighten this out, this problem, before it gets worse. And it will get worse if you don't straighten it out. But now that you're depressed and you see the depression is based on a jealousy, so then deal with the jealousy. You see? And then he says that the Ramban explains the next part of the verse, that you can repent. In other words, you can repent. It's up to you. It's totally in your hands whether you will change, whether you give in to this emotion or change your emotion. It is totally in your hands, you see. And since Cain gave in to the emotion and he didn't undo it, he didn't repent, so therefore, you see, he took the next step in that emotion, and he actually killed his brother. That is the way Nachmanides learns that the verse, which happens to be verse 7 in chapter 4 of Genesis. All right, let me try to explain. Let's say, for instance, I try to make a living, but the economy is bad. So I feel bad. I can't support my family. I see my family. That's irrational. In other words, it's rational to feel bad in that situation. It's not. I mean, look, you see, it's the catastrophe for your family and for yourself. So you feel bad. It's not in your hands. You need food. It's a practical thing to have food. But here we're not talking about a practical thing. Here we're talking about a jealousy. You could definitely bring a better sacrifice and straighten it out and do a better. You could definitely change that. But you're jealous of him. You're jealous of his success, according to Nachmanides. So therefore, if you're jealous of his success, deal with that. That's why you're depressed. That depression shows that there's something that it's a fantasy, that it's not the practical thing. It has nothing to do with the practical world, the everyday world. It's just a fantasy, the way you look at life, you see. So therefore, you must recognize when you're depressed, there's a rational, sometimes there's a reason why you're depressed. It fits in, you know, but sometimes it doesn't. Then you have to check the emotion. What emotion? Of course, that emotion could only get worse. The thing is that the question is that once you're in a depression, it's very hard to get out of it. I think that if it's a practical thing, it's a practical thing that you have problems with the physical world, I think that a person, if they're trained to think, they will try to work out a plan. Like, for instance, Abraham had a problem. He had to make a decision between a land of famine or to move down to a land that were evil people, that were like Nazis, let's say. They're really evil, you see. So he had to work it out that I have to go down there because maybe I can work it out somehow, but here I'm definitely. In other words, it seemed to be that over here I have a 1% chance of living, and over there I have a 4% chance of living. So I'll take the 4% chance. So you could work out a plan if you're a practical situation. But where it's your own emotions, wherever you go, you're taking these emotions with you. You can't make a plan. You must deal with the emotions. See, one takes a plan about the physical world and how to deal with the physical world. It has to be a strategy in the physical world. The other, the strategy has to be how to deal with my own emotions. Because I can't go any, I can't have a strategy to move because I'm taking my emotions with me. It'll only affect me in the new place wherever I go. You see? So it's two different situations. One is a practical one, and one is an inner one. An inner one. In other words, where my own emotions are driving me crazy. You see? That, a different type of plan. It's a plan of dealing with the emotions and how to deal with emotions. In other words, if you're so depressed that you can't operate, in either case, whether it's practical or not, then you really, then there's nothing you can do. I mean, you have to deal with that emotion, if possible, with that depression to get yourself to work, to get yourself to do, the only way you can cure yourself is through one of two strategies, either the strategy of the practical or the strategy of dealing with your own emotions. So what's the correct plan insofar as you are concerned to deal with your emotions? But if you're so depressed that you can't deal with either one, then you have to deal with the depression. And usually, since you can't deal with it, you have to make sure there's somebody else there that can help you out in that situation, pull you out of that situation until you can do it for yourself. But if you're aware of that problem, you can deal with the problem, not when it's happening, but, you know, at another time. Then you can look back and try to deal with the problem of that. That also is in itself a problem that has to be dealt with. In other words, the verse says anger and the depression. Now, anger is and depression are two sides of the same coin. So first he was very depressed. That was where it was turned in. And then because it bothered him so much, he was so much in pain, so that brought out the anger against his brother, even though he was the cause of the situation. So to deny that he's the cause of the situation, he turns against his brother. You see? Turns against his brother. But it's anger and depression are two sides of the same coin. Now again, even anger, there are two types of anger. like it says in the verse, it says, those that love God hate evil. So if you get angry at an evil person, that's the emotion is in line with reality. So that's good. You understand? But then there's a hatred as a result of your own conflicts, of your own ego, you see, that's a problem. So therefore, here his ego was hurt, so first he got depressed. Then the way out of depression, that he shouldn't have to think about his own faults and his own problems, so the anger came forth against his brother, and he destroyed his brother. So he says, in other words, all my problems is because of him. If I get rid of him, I won't have the problem. You see? So it's the same problem, but it's two sides of the same coin, two different angles. It's operating in two different angles of the same emotion. Even though you have all these problems, these conflicts, you see, the verse says that you can't change. That's why God spoke to Cain, say that you can change and you could deal with it. But Cain couldn't, for some reason he decided not to. There was a powerful emotion, whatever it was, or free will, whatever it was, however he decided, it's not clear, but however, you see that he just allowed the emotion to take over. He allowed the emotion to take over, and that's what happened. But a person can deal with it. The question, situation, you could either deal with it before or after. But how do you deal with it during during? The answer is that that's a certain development. When you start out, you can't do it. You see? But however, you see by King David that Nathan the prophet told him that you're the one, he points to David, that you're the one that did this sin. David gets very angry Nathan made up a whole story about there was a rich man, and wanted to make a party, and he took the poor man only had one sheep, and he took away his sheep for his party. So David gets off his throne, he says, tell me who that guy is, and I'll take care of it, you know? So Nathan says, you're the guy. So he, right after that, King David says, Chatasi, I sinned. You see? That's King David, in the throes of the emotion, you see? I think we could reach such a level, or close to it, but that also in itself takes a development. That in itself takes a development. So at the beginning, you're right. When you're first starting out, you can't do it. Just can't do it. I assume Cain was able to do it, or not, God would not have spoken to him. So Cain must have been able to do it. And now why should God, if he has no ability to do it, then why is God speaking to him? It's helpless. And why should he get punished? It's just helpless. Well, let him, that's it. But the only thing is that he must have had the ability to deal with it. But he chose not to. You see? So therefore, that in itself. So at the beginning, you're right. You have to start thinking about it either after the emotion or before the emotion happens, but not during. But then you could work it out that even during the throes of the emotion, you could think about it. It's possible. The question is that, let's say, for instance, you're in the throes of emotion. In the throes of the emotion, you do something harmful to somebody else. Okay? Question is, can you be held responsible for that? Right? The answer is, you see that Cain was held responsible. You see that he was. That you have, in other words, when you're born, you have your personality. And Cain had his personality. That he can't do anything about. The fact that he was depressed over with his brother, that he couldn't do anything about. But when he was depressed, then he should have realized, when he feels the depression, he says, why am I depressed? He should ask, why am I depressed? And here he had God to help him with it, to explain the nature of the depression. He helped him out. God helped him out. You see? But we have to do it on our own. If not during the depression, at least when the depression passes. You see? But you have the responsibility to deal with it. You see? If you don't deal with it, then you're responsible. If you do deal with it, then you're given a certain amount of time to deal with it. You see? You have to have a certain amount of time to deal with the problem. And so you should. That's why the earlier you start, the better off you are before the problems really get big. And you even see with repentance that even after he did the murder, God still helped him out, made him an everlasting wanderer, so he would have time to deal with this emotion, and he could still repent.
Talking about Abel.
The question is what lesson can we learn from the fact that Hevel was a righteous person and he didn't live out his life? In other words, Cain killed him, and yet he was a righteous person. The answer is that there is a certain amount of responsibility that we have to protect ourselves in this world. And one of the things that we have to protect ourselves from is people that are jealous of us. And if we don't protect ourselves from people that are jealous of us, then that is also our responsibility. In other words, like this. Let's say, for instance, I'm a person is a wealthy person, right? That is two ways he could relate to his wealth. He could show his wealth, buy very expensive cars and very big houses to show his wealth, which would awaken the jealousy of others, or he could cover it up. And two, when he speaks to others, he should be very careful that naturally he should know that people are jealous. So he should be very, very careful of how he expresses himself. And two, since he knows that jealous people could hurt him, so then when people are jealous of him, he has to protect himself from it. You see? Now, whether Abel was in a situation that he could protect himself from Cain, that he should have realized or he couldn't realize, this I don't know. There's no information in the verse about it. But the best thing I could tell you is that a person has a responsibility to protect himself against these different emotions, because these different emotions that other people have about you can do you harm, and you have the responsibility to protect yourself. And a large part of the study of Misa through Torah is how to protect yourself from evil people. One is not to become evil. How to protect yourself from becoming evil. That's one type of lesson. And then, once you become wise, how to protect yourself from other people that are wicked. So you have that responsibility to protect yourself. They're both similar, but two aspects of the same study. In other words, your emotions, once you understand your emotions, then you understand how other people's emotions work, then you know you have to protect yourself from other people. In other words, in Abel in particular, I don't have any information about it, whether he was able to, whether it was his fault or not his fault, to be able to recognize that Cain could hurt him. That I don't know. I'm just saying in general, that's the lesson that a person should learn. From the aspect of, from Evel's aspect. Now, sages say that a person should have his home, a place where wise people come to learn. You see, that would go back to explain atmosphere. You see, a person should always make their home an atmosphere of learning and ideas. Ideas about God, ideas about whatever it is. And if you have people coming in, wise people coming in to learn, so there's a certain atmosphere of learning there. And the child is raised in that atmosphere has a better chance. But the person is doing it for himself because he holds from that value system. You see? But if you only do it for the children, then you don't have then they'll sense that you don't have this value system. If it's so important for me, the child will say, why aren't you doing it? You see? So you must do it for yourself. You must see it's so important that you do it for yourself. And you set up a certain atmosphere in the home. We're in Judges 5, verse 24. This is still Deborah's song of praise to God. And she says, Ya'el, the wife of Heber the Cainy, in other words, that was the one that killed Sisera, is blessed more than other women. More than the women in the tent is she blessed? Okay? Question is, or what is Devorah saying? What does it mean she's blessed more than other women in the tent? She's blessed more than other women. Then it says she's blessed more than other women in the tent. What does the tent have anything to do with this? That was verse 24. The thing is, what Yael did was immodest. She invited a man when nobody was home. She invited a man into the privacy of her of a tent, you say, which was immodest, you say. But yet she is more praiseworthy than all the... She is more blessed, and that means more praiseworthy than all the women have modesty. What is it saying? I mean, modesty is a trait that we always advocate. You understand? But the thing is, in every law of the Torah, there's always, except for idolatry, there is always a some other way of doing it. In other words, there's a certain situation where you're not obligated to maintain that law. Right? Now, the thing is, what we're saying is that even though she was immodest, you see, but the fact is that she did something for the Jewish nation and for God, and for as she was doing in the what God's will is. So therefore, because of that, in this situation, we the laws of modesty are removed, and she and it is the right thing to do. In other words, it's very much against her, and most people's, especially if you're not a warrior in those days. Today, even a warrior in these days, it's hard to take a stake and knock it through a person's brain. That's what she did. But she did that for the sake of God, and she for the will of God, and to save Israel, which God wanted that to happen. And because of that, the rules of immodesty were removed to in that situation. Okay? So... That's what Devorah is trying to say, that you shouldn't condemn her for being immodest. She's doing the right thing in this situation. The question is, how do you know when to do something and to give up another thing? In what situation? How do you know to tell the difference? The only way you can tell is by the study of law. You have to know where the law tells it. There's no other way. If you don't know the law, then you don't know what situations to give in on and which situations you should stand firm. You have to know the law. You can't make it up on your own when you decide to give in. You have to know, you have to define clearly the situation in which these laws should be given up. You see? So that has to be defined in every case. You have to know it beforehand. That's right. We have to assume that she was versed in the laws that were applied to her. Okay? It is really not breaking the law. All laws are subdivided. Like, for instance, you're not allowed to pass a red light. But what about a fire engine? A fire engine can. It's not that he's breaking the law. It's that the law doesn't apply to him in that situation. Course of danger to life. Same thing on the Sabbath. You're not allowed to drive on the Sabbath. It's a matter of life and death. You're obligated to. It's not that you're allowed to violate the law. The law just doesn't apply in that situation. Okay? Okay, we're in chapter 6 of Judges, and basically the story is that the Jews did what was evil in the eyes of God, and they were under Midian, the nation of Midian, for 7 years. Okay? And they really tormented the Jews, and they brought in other nations, and they used to come not to rob them. One thing is to rob, but here they came to torment them and to destroy things just to make life miserable and to keep them in poverty and broken. Okay? And the Jews called out to God. Now you have to understand these people were idol worshippers, but still there was some remnant of the old way, and they called out to God. And when they called out to God, so God sent a prophet. Some people say it's a prophet. Some people say this man Gideon had a vision. Anyway, he came to Gideon and he told him, I'm sorry, he didn't come to Gideon, he came to the Jews. Came to all the Jews, I'm sorry, this is before Gideon. He came to all the Jews and he told them the history of how God saved them, God took them out of Egypt, and how he destroyed the enemy in Israel, and when they first came into Israel. And he says how he saved them from the different, from the Egyptians. And I said to you, this is what God says at that, and I said to you at that time, that I am the Lord your God, don't be afraid of the God of the Amori, in other words, the strange gods, that you will dwell in their land. And it says, and you did not listen to me. Okay? Now, the thing is that, why did God say this now? I mean, they didn't listen to him. I mean, okay, so fine. I mean, you don't throw it in their face. Why is God telling them that you didn't listen to me? God is telling the Jews that you didn't listen to me. Why is God saying that? The answer is that to cure yourself of any disease, you have to know the cause. Same thing in religiosity. If you have a effect, some type of, where God has affected you, God has put you in a terrible situation, so then the cure must be in, you must know what the cure is. What God is saying is the disease is that you did not listen to me. And since you did not listen to me and you turned to the gods, the strange gods of the people of the land of Canaan, or from other nations, so therefore you're being punished. Okay? So therefore the cure has to be in the undoing of the idols. Later on it says that, he should build he built an altar to God, right? And that night, God said to him that he should take the ox. They had two types of oxen. One ox was set aside for the idol when they first went into exile, when they first lost out 7 years earlier. They had one that they set aside for 7 years. And they had also a younger bull that was saved for the idol, for the Baal. He says, so you should take those two, rip up the altar of the Baal that belongs to your father, right? And the Asherah was a certain tree which they worship. He says you should cut it down. Then you should rebuild an altar to God, and you should take the second ox, and you should bring it up as a burnt offering, and you should use the wood of the Asherah that you cut down. Okay, this is what God is telling him. Okay, here again, what is the cause of the of all your troubles? It's because you're worshiping these idols. Says, so use these idols as a means to worship God, even though according to Halacha you're not allowed to use these things for a sacrifice, but however God told them that anything that's set aside for an idol you're not allowed to use for a sacrifice, but God told them in this situation he had to. And the Ralbach says the reason why is that he should learn to this idea that he must remove the cause and to turn to God, so as he should learn, in other words, he should recognize the cause of all this catastrophe is because of these idols. And when you destroy them and turn to God, then you will, God can save you. You understand? In other words, when people cry unto God for God's help, God doesn't save them right away. They have to be educated. They have to be on a certain level for God to save them. So what God does, he sends people to educate them. Then when they're educated, then they can reach a level where God can actually save them. Part of the education is to look into yourself and to see exactly what I did wrong. If you can't see what you did wrong, then there's nothing to do. You can't do anything. To cure yourself, you must see what you did wrong. So therefore, in this case, God, first of all, when he spoke to the nation, when he sent the prophet to speak to the nation, he told them because you didn't listen to God. And then to Gideon in particular, he guides him by sacrificing the idol of the Baal and using the wood of the idol. They had the tree which they worship. Using that wood, he burnt the sacrifice, you see, and that would help him to break the identification, his identification with the idols. When he destroys it, it shows an act of a breaking of his identification, and he's able to, it helps him psychologically to pull out and to move in towards the true idea into the world of ideas. There is a law called Hara'ashah, which with God, which must be done through God or a prophet of God, that you're allowed to violate the law in a particular situation. The laws are suspended, but the halachic laws are suspended for this situation. You see? So this was one of the laws that God, this is one of the situations that God suspended the halachic laws of the Torah, and that you're allowed to do it for the, according to the Ralbag, for the education of Gideon. And then the next day when the people saw it, they would also see it. So when they would see it, so they'd also maybe learn from it also, to try to educate them that the greatest thing is the relationship to God. You must break that religious feeling that turns towards idolatry, but turn towards the true God. This, of course, applies in the laws of nature, too. If something goes wrong in everyday life, you don't know what it is, sometimes you have to check within yourself either what you did wrong. Let's say you get a certain consequence. Now, it's easy to immediately blame others, but it's hard to check in yourself and say, just one minute, maybe there is one aspect that brought this consequence about. And if I undo that with that part of me which brings it about, won't happen again. You see? So therefore, in all cases, whenever there are bad consequences, you must check back either within the laws of nature, or if you know it's caused by God, then you must look back into where you violated your relationship with God. There is another idea in the story, and that God told them to do it at night. The question is, why should you do it at night? Sacrifices are usually done by day. Why should you do it by night? Okay? So the answer is that, if he did it by daytime, the whole public would be there. They would stop him from doing it. They would stop him from bringing the sacrifice, you see. So the thing is, he had to do it at night. He got 10 people, I guess 10 people he could trust. Got 10 people that he could trust and brought them together so that there should be like, in other words, he's doing a sacrifice in public and to recognize it, but he couldn't do it in front of the whole community because they really would stop him from destroying these idols they still haven't pulled out from this situation of relating to idols. They still hadn't changed to relating to God. You see, they would have stopped them. So the Rambam points out that whenever you're going to do something, sometimes you can't do it in the best possible way, but you have to do it, in other words, it might have been better if there were thousands of people there, but however, since it will not come about, so then you have to do it in a quiet way. So you have to know when to do things like you're making God's name holy. You could do it that you will be stopped, so it's not going to occur altogether. Well, sometimes it's better to do it in a quiet way so that it will be accomplished. In other words, you can't always stand up to everybody. You have to know when to stand up and when not to stand up. Sometimes there's situations where it's time to stand up. Sometimes the situation is just back off and do it privately, because nobody's going to stand, everybody's going to stop you from doing it. So you have to know when and where. And also you see here that God is telling him, God definitely could have pushed it through, but God also works within the framework of the situation. You see that God relates to us in our framework. Sometimes God does it, like by Egypt. There was miracles and open, and he destroyed the Egyptians. But sometimes the situation demands that God says that the best situation is to do it in such a way to get the job done, and let's not make it a big deal. So you see, even God set it up, because he holds that this situation is a situation where you must get the job done, not by standing up against everybody, but by getting the job done. That is why God told him he should do it at night. And he even got 10 people he could trust, so that it should be done in public, to a definition of public, but not in front of the whole city. It says, we're there dealing with Proverbs, chapter 28, verse 1. It says, if somebody flees, he's running away, and nobody's chasing him, that's a wicked person. But the righteous are like young lions, and they are secure. The righteous are secure. Okay? That's the verse. I repeat. All right? It says, if you flee, if you run away, like you're running away, you're frightened, somebody's chasing you, but there's really nobody chasing you, that's a wicked person. But the righteous are like young lions. He is secure. He will be secure. Now, the first question is why would somebody run away if nobody's chasing them? Well, why, what is he running from? What makes him run? Okay? The question is a righteous person so righteous he feels so secure that he can't make any mistakes? How is that possible? You know what I mean? That he feels that nothing could go wrong with his life, that nothing is going to come after him. What kind of a... That's really egotistical. That wouldn't be a righteous person. It's a good question. You have to know, whenever you have a metaphor, the reason why they give a metaphor is they're giving something that I wouldn't have gotten without the metaphor. In other words, it should just say that the tzaddik is secure. Why did I have to say like a young lion? You see? What is he adding about the young lion that there's something that I wouldn't have known if he didn't have that metaphor? A young lion, what we mean by a young lion, we mean a lion in his prime, not a baby in the mother by the mother. It's a lion in its prime. That's a kfir. When you use the word kfir, it's a lion in its prime. The reason why the young lion is secure is because they have no predators to destroy them. Every animal, how strong they are, they always have a predator that they have to be afraid of. There's some predator that's above them. But the one that's the highest on the chain, they have no fear. So the lion does not have any animal that it has to fear. There is none that it has to fear, you see. In reality, there is none that it has to fear. So therefore, if there is none that it has to fear, so then there is no worry by nature. Okay? So why does that help us with the verse? Right, so we want to say that the same thing applies to a righteous person. There is, when he looks at the physical world, okay, he only relates to it in a realistic manner. So when he relates to it in a realistic manner, there are things that could hurt him. There are wicked people that could hurt him. There is certain laws of nature that could hurt him. There's diseases that could hurt him. But it's all within the laws of nature. There's nothing something which is outside the laws of nature. There is nothing outside the laws of nature. And then that even within the laws of nature, he trusts in God, and so therefore, because of his trust in God, so he operates like this. He does everything that is necessary within the laws of nature. That which is out of his hands, he trusts in God. He turns to God for him, and whatever God's will, he accepts God's will for good or for bad. He trusts God's will, so he has nothing to be afraid of. There is nothing to be afraid of. It doesn't mean he can't make a mistake. It doesn't mean there aren't real problems in the physical world, but he is not afraid. There is nothing to be afraid of. Either there's something there's nothing that is impractical that he's afraid of. If it's practical, so then he he'll take care of it to the best of his ability. Where he can't take care of it, so then he'll turn to God and rely on God, and he'll accept God's will. If everything works out, so he'll accept that God was good to him. But if something bad happens, so then he accepts that that's God's will for whatever reason. Whatever the reason is, he accepts it. He accepts God's will. So therefore, there's absolutely nothing to be afraid of in the physical world. That is the righteous person. Okay, so now we come to the question of who is the wicked person running from, and there's nobody chasing him. In other words, it's not even based on reality. Why is that happening? The first step that we have to take is that he is not relating to the physical world as a reality. He's relating somehow to the physical world through his own mind, through his own emotions, through his own view of life. But not based, his view of life is not based on reality, but his view of life is based on his own personal view which he has of life, and it might not have nothing to do with reality or very little to do with reality. That is the first step. Okay? Then what happens? Now, if the whole world is only in his mind, so then when he looks out to the world and the world doesn't really work according to his view, so he has to project that onto the world. In other words, let's say, for instance, let's take an example of a cynic, okay? A cynic is a person that looks at the at people that everything they do is for a bad motive. In other words, either they look at an act, they turn a good act into a bad act, that it's really a bad act, or they take a good act that really is a good act, and he says his motive is a bad motive. He looks at everything in a that's cynical. He looks at everything in a bad way, right? So his philosophy is that nobody could do anything because it's objectively right. They can only do things for their own personal view of life. Okay? That's their view, right? In other words, what they have is a certain view of themselves. The truth is they have a certain view of themselves, that the view is that I'm only self-serving and I only do things for myself. And everything I do, even if it's nice, it's only for myself. So since they have that, they can't look at themselves that way, so they create a philosophy that that's the world. And the world is, everybody looks at life that way. That's why they become cynical, that everybody does things for bad, either they reinterpret a good act into a bad act, or they take a good act and give it a bad motive, so that it could never, ever be a good act. It could never be anything as defined as a good act, you see? That is their philosophy, and therefore, whenever they look at people, they look at people in a very, very negative way. They could never let themselves be close to anybody, because nobody could ever really be their friend. If anybody wants to be their friend, it's only for self-serving. They always think, well, what does he want out of it? Why does he want to be my friend? He must want to get something out of it, you see? So therefore, he immediately starts... he can't relate to anybody. Based on that incorrect philosophy, he has a problem relating
to somebody. He took his own emotions, created it into a philosophy of life, and looks at life that way. You see? So the same thing with the wicked people is they create a certain philosophy. Like, for instance, most of the great tyrants, they couldn't be wrong. They are 100% right. Whatever they decide is right. And anybody that disagrees with them is wrong and deserves the death penalty for that. You see? That's the way the tyrant made decisions. You see? Now, so therefore, just like he's out to destroy others that disagree with him, he has a fear that other people are going to come after him. Because of his lifestyle, he has a fear of people. You see? So there's different types of, these types of philosophies that you create that is not in line with reality, you see? So then what happens is that then you're running from that which you have created. You understand? You're really afraid. What made you frightened is your own philosophy of life that you have created based on your emotions. So you create a philosophy of life, so you project that onto the world, that philosophy. When you project that onto the world of that philosophy and it really doesn't exist, so then you become very, very frightened. You become very frightened of people because you created those people. You created it. It might not be anybody chasing you, but you have a fear of people chasing you. That is the difference between the tzaddik and the rasha. Tzaddik is guided by reality. He accepts reality for what it is, or he accepts God for whatever God does, and therefore, good or bad, he accepts reality. He has nothing to be afraid of. He will protect himself where he sees there's something wrong, but however, he is not afraid of reality. He accepts it. The wicked person who creates his philosophy, so wherever his philosophy is not equal to, especially when it deals with people, how he looks at people, you see, so he's going to condemn people for his own shortcomings. And what he doesn't want to see in himself, so he condemns them that they're going to do these same things to him. That's who he's running from. Really, he's running from his own ghost. I'd like to give an introduction to Mishlei, Proverbs. I know I've given quite a number of them, but one more. A student asked me a question like this. It says, what is depression, and how do you deal with it?
Depression,
right. So, what? Anyway, the question, alright, so the question was, what is depression? I want to say that depression is that the conscience evaluates how, what you're doing, whether it's right or wrong. Okay? And the conscience evaluates you, and the conscience says, you are not up to par. You're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, and so therefore you feel guilty. That's where then you get depressed. That's why you get depressed. Because you're not doing that which the conscience demands of you. Now, the conscience could be demanding of you some unconscious thing that you're not even aware of, and it could be demanding of you things that are way beyond your ability. And so therefore, many times, there is, like it seems to be, there is no answer how to deal with it. And whether you're clinically depressed or just a regular depression, dependent how strong your conscience is, so that's a matter of quantity. Most people have a certain amount of depression, you know, they get depressed for a while, and then they go back to life. Some people can't, and they're clinically depressed. Okay, but that is the idea of the depression. Now the question is that how do you get out of it? Of course, if you're clinically depressed, I assume that you would need professional help. But I'm talking about the normal human being that can operate but gets depressed more or less. You know, sometimes some people more, some people less, but they get depressed. And the question is how to deal with it. I think that the best way that would deal... See, the thing is that
I'm only giving this conflict as an example, but every conflict that you have is the battle between your conscience and the animalistic parts, the animalistic desires. And you have certain desires, and the conscience tells you you can't do it. Or the conscience demands that you do something that you don't want to do. Or the conscience demands more than you have the ability to do. So the thing is this is where the conflict comes in, and all the different conflicts come about that way. It makes no difference. If you notice all the opposites and different traits that the Torah talks about, really are really these two parts. In other words, let's say greed and stinginess, or spendthrift and stinginess. Spendthrift comes from the animalistic part. I just want to spend and do and do. While stinginess comes from the conscience, control. You see? So if you go through all the traits and all the opposites, you will find one is the animalistic part and one part is the conscience. So all the traits are different aspects of these two parts, and this is where the conflict comes about. Now the thing is, it is possible to change the conscience by changing your value system. Okay? In other words, like this. The conscience just says, let's say, for instance, being dirty. So being dirty is bad. So you can't be dirty. If you walk around dirty, so you feel guilty or you feel ashamed, you feel depressed, you don't feel good about yourself, right? The conscience comes down on you for being dirty. Let's say we would say, well, what's wrong with being dirty? What are the consequences of being dirty? Okay? So we would say, well, if it's certain type of dirt is germs and you can get sick. Let's say you're messy and you're not really dirty, or you have a stain, you're not going to get sick over it. Well, then you have to relate to people, and people won't want to be with you, could lose friendships, and people won't respect you in certain situations where you need that respect, or you can't get a job. So the thing is that there are certain consequences for dressing dirty. What about in your house? If you just dress messy and you're not sick, and then it's not something that can make you sick, you understand? So what's wrong with it? You say, there's no consequence. Why do I have to always be clean or not messy? You say? So the thing is that you, unless it takes away from the order of the house and you can't find things, so the consequences is that you'll have a hard time in finding things. So what I'm trying to get at is the conscience just says, you are wrong. The authority saying, you are wrong. You see? While reality says, the only reasons why things are wrong is because they lead to consequences. So therefore, if every time I think something is wrong, I start thinking about what are the consequences, so I'm changing from the conscience type of value system, which I received before I could even think, you understand, before I could make decisions and value judgments, and I'm changing that to a realistic situation. And so therefore, I move slowly but surely, as I think this way, I move away from the conscience value system to a realistic type of value system. And that should help from the conflicts of the conscience. So somebody asked the question like this. They asked the question, but if, let's say, I can't live up to the realistic expectations, if I can't live up to realistic expectations, then it could be worse. If it's only my emotions, so it's a fake out, you know what I mean? But if it's a realistic thing, I mean, that could really be painful. Like, I really know this is reality, and I can't
live up to it, right? The answer is, if you ever had a battle with your spouse, and your spouse screams or yells at you, that's one thing. Yeah, you're unhappy about it. What if your spouse suddenly just stops speaking to you? Which is worse? Definitely, everybody answers not speaking. Also, if you're with somebody and you're talking, you enjoy the conversation. As soon as the conversation stops, you feel uncomfortable. Okay? Also, in discipline, I one time tried a class, and when the class would get noisy, I would just stop and wait for the class to... that works better than all my screaming, even though personality-wise I always scream, and I like to scream, so I gave that up. Didn't work with my personality, but that was the better way of disciplining. Question is why? Why does, when it's quiet, do you feel so uncomfortable? The answer is that because your unconscious takes over and tells you what's going on in that situation. In other words, let's say, for instance, if I tell you I'm going to punish you, well, whatever the punishment is, practice to visualize. Let's say I don't say anything and I just stand there, then the unconscious starts imagining what I'm going to do. It never comes to the conscious mind, but there's a certain feeling of the worst catastrophe that could happen. You see, the unconscious takes over, and you see the unconscious type of fear or down is much worse than when it's realistic. In fact, a lot of people, when they move away from the conscience type of value system and they go to the realistic value system, they say, well, that's all just a consequence, so why should I worry about it altogether? Like, consequence is not as strong as the emotional impact of the of your emotions. You see, it's a catastrophe. You see? So the thing is that it's your own emotions that are interpreting this situation. You see? And therefore, in other words, when your spouse screams at you, so you hear exactly what they say. It's very practical. Well, you might agree, you might disagree, you might fight back, whatever. But however, when they stop speaking, you see, then you imagine all your unconscious fears or your unconscious bad self-image. You understand? All this comes into play, you see? And that is worse than what anybody could say. So therefore, the realistic type of value system is not as powerful, and sometimes it's harder to do. You have to be a thinker to really live with it, you see? It's not as powerful, and if you don't live up to it, so you look at it realistically, you say, okay, I can't do this, what could I do? You understand? Like, certain people are getting